This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
City Limits. Brought to us by the People's Committee for Melbourne every Wednesday at 9am.
City Limits is Melbourne's only hour devoted to our urban environment.
To transport and planning and housing issues.
To privatisations and our utility services.
To building and or maintaining a sense of community. 855 on the AM band, if we can hear it through the noise and find it through the smog.
City Limits.
Okay, City Limits and the tar and cement. And the Kate Shaw, of course, was part of the People's Committee, or the People's Committee for Melbourne, that started this program all those years ago. And she's on the line. We'll go to her in a moment. But Kate, before we get to you, we're going to have we'll just to let listeners know we're reversing the order today. We're going to have our interview in the first half, our main interview, and we'll do our normal rave in the second half of the program because Kate has to get away, so she's on first. Kate Shaw, of course, well-known activist on housing, etc., geographer at Melbourne. But Kate, we have to pour the tea, which is very important because Anne can't live without it. And Maxwell's over there. I'm Kevin Healy, and I'm just pouring the tea.
Can't live without the rave. Can't live without the tea.
Vietnamese green tea today, Anne.
Ooh,
you've got a choice of a cup with dots on it or a lime green cup. Which one do you want?
Let's go dots.
You're going dots, all right. Now we can get to Kate Shaw. Kate, I want to talk to you about the budget impact, but firstly, there was a report in the last week or so by some economists who looked at affordable housing and said that it's a complete waste of money by government and does nothing to address the people it's supposed to help. Have you seen that report?
I've seen a lot of reports. I think I saw that one. But yes, absolutely, of course. And a lot of people have been saying that for a long time.
Well, yes. I mean,
it
makes the point that the government, the money the government gives to developers to provide so-called affordable housing would be far better spent on the government itself providing genuinely affordable housing. I think that's the point of the report.
Yeah, absolutely. The problem is with what is with the definition of what is regarded as affordable. Most Victorian government provided affordable housing is 90% of market rent, and in the city of Melbourne, in the whole metropolitan region of Melbourne, that's affordable to less than 50% of the population. So, you know, I mean, the definition of affordable housing is that no household is paying more than 30% of its income in rent or on a mortgage. So in order for a household to be not paying more than 30% of its income on 90% of market rent, the median market rent in Melbourne, they need to be earning at least $120,000 a year gross. If they're earning any less than that, they're going to be paying more than 30% of their income in rent or mortgage.
And that's a point they also make. They point out, they list a couple where the one in Bondi was listed as affordable. It was $925 a week, or $48,000 a year, as they say. One in Queens Road in Melbourne, $561 a week, affordable. And they point out you'd need to be earning up to, you know, $100,000 or something to be able for that to be
that's
a third
right.
of your
more.
Income.
Yeah. A lot more.
Yeah,
that's right. So affordable to whom is the question, but affordable to people on statutory incomes? No. Only public housing is affordable to people on statutory incomes, on pensions or unemployment benefits or, you know, whatever.
Yeah, and of course. Go on. Sorry.
Yeah. No.
Well, I'm going to say they also get, you know, government concessions for providing some affordable, but then we've seen a few cases recently where, as it got to the point of actually the product being produced, the affordable housing disappeared off the scene.
Well, indeed. Yeah. So Assemble is the latest kind of, you know, sort of social enterprise developer that had permissions for quite an excess in height limit in a couple of developments in Merribeck.
Yeah.
And got a whole range of incentives and tax reliefs and so on the basis that I think it was something like a 60% component of the housing that it was building was affordable. Now, in the case of Assemble, I think affordable housing is more like 75 to 80% of market rent rather than 90. So that definition of affordable varies depending on who's doing it. But even then, 75% is a bit better than 90% of market rent. But after all of the concessions were received and construction started, Assemble turned around and said they weren't able to make a stack up. And so the affordable component has been reduced from 60 to, I think, 20%.
Yes, a sharp reduction anyway. That's,
yes.
And there's
yes.
an example
but they've collected all of the concessions.
Of course. Well, of course.
And they've continued to keep the height increase, which is pretty amazing stuff. Merribeck was opposed to those concessions being, continued. That they said Assemble had to either deliver what they promised or hand some of the concessions back. But the state government overrode them and said, no, that's fine.
And Citadetto, there's the development up in Northcote at the moment, the Greek Orthodox Church, which seems like a massive overdevelopment, but they're got all sorts of things. But they've got concessions also because they're including affordable housing. But if you read down, you find that the affordable housing is going to be 3% of the dwellings, which is the minimum to meet the affordable housing threshold. So they're doing it just to get the concessions, and what will be in the end, who knows?
Yeah, exactly. It's a scam. And I think more and more people are coming on, becoming wise to that.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on to the federal budget because it has caused, the capitalists have gone for the smelling salts.
Yeah.
The crisis in capitalism, apparently, but it is supposed to be going to make housing more affordable and rentals more affordable. Does it stack up, Kate?
Look, I think what will happen with the changes to negative gearing in the future on existing property. I'm sure everybody's aware purchases of existing dwellings from next July will not be able to be negatively geared. All existing arrangements being grandfathered. So everybody, this is where the meritocracy is just so poisonously disingenuous. The federal government has been way kinder than it really needs to be. But when you've got the meritocracy hanging around, and even reports in The Age are going hysterical. It's like, with friends like these, who needs Sky News? But
try the Finn Review, it's gone ape.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it's really nuts. I mean, so existing property owners are not affected at all. But for future purchases of existing dwellings, not new builds, the negative gearing arrangements will be withdrawn from July next year. The capital gains tax discount, which is currently discounted at 50%. So only 50% of your capital gain when you sell a place will be taxed. That has been removed and it will be taken away again from July next year. Now, that's a great move. And I fully support the removal of negative gearing from existing properties as well. The objective there is to send investors into new builds. They can still negatively gear a newly built apartment. That's oriented at increasing housing supply. I think most of your listeners know my view on that. It's not really going to make much of a difference to the housing affordability because it's all going to be market housing. And if prices start to drop, the developers will stop building. So, that's whatever. That's a whole other discussion, really, what the effect of new builds will be. They might have a little bit of effect on increasing types of properties and locations of properties for people who are looking for a first home or a place to rent, but they're not going to have any impact on affordability. What will have an impact on affordability to a very small degree is the fact that there won't be the same sort of competition for existing houses at auction, first home buyers, right? First home buyers won't be competing against investors for an existing house that investors can negatively gear. So with the lack of competition at auction, prices won't get pushed up in a way that they do with, you know, estate agents drooling and, you know, facilitating, you know, the blood sport that is auctions these days. But it still won't bring prices down. I mean, at best, it will allow prices to stabilise a little bit. And so first home buyers, if they're already in a position that they might be able to buy somewhere, have got a better chance of winning at auction because they're not going to be competing with cashed up investors. But that's going to be, you know, really the extent of the effect of the federal budget changes on affordability.
Well, some people who really care about those who need to get a roof over their head, like Mark Burris and Shane Oliver for AMP, argued that the prediction that rents would rise by $2 a week, which was in the budget, is way off mark, and they're going to rise by much more. Are they on the ball again or not?
Oh, aren't they always? look, it's hard. It's hard to predict. There's a whole lot of modelling, as I'm sure listeners are aware. I mean, there are economists who say, some rents will go down. There are some that say they'll go up. They'll go up a lot. It's going to be all over the place, I think. There will be investors who, because they can't negatively... Well, you see, the thing is, they can negatively gear their existing places and they'll continue to do so. Investors in new properties, if they can't negatively gear, they say they will put the rent up to cover their losses. There are two sort of caveats on that, I think. One is that there are restrictions on how much they can charge. If they go well above market rent, that can be challenged. But also, market rent is already unaffordable. So as far as people who are looking at buying into that kind of, or renting in that kind of market, they're already excluded. You follow me? The changes are not going to increase rents that much more than what the market allows for now anyway.
Indeed. In fact, there was a report from Anglicare just 2 weeks ago, Kate, I'm sure you probably saw it, which said that even households on median incomes are being priced out of large parts of the country. In all but 10 electorates, the median rent is now unaffordable for a household on the median income.
That's right.
It's serious, obviously.
Yeah, that's right. But the point is that none of these changes are going to bring rents down. They will in some instances to varying degrees, and you know it's just really hard to know how future investors act. One of the more positive elements, I think, is that those investors who are, you know, sort of screaming blue murder and do not invest. So again, don't forget, the existing investors with negatively geared properties can continue to negatively gear them. So all this, I'm going to sell it. It's like, well, yes, why? but if you do, good. Then that might go into a pool of properties that are more available to first home buyers. you know, which is that category that is often talked about by politicians, but people don't actually give it that much thought. So, I mean, the mass sale of, investment properties is a fine thing. In the unlikely event that these changes would precipitate that, right? Because it's actually not logical. But were they to sell, and were the market to be flooded, shock horror, with existing rental properties, that would possibly be the best thing for the city that we could see, because it would mean that then prices actually might come down a little bit.
But of course,
the upshot is that the changes are not actually going to make all that much difference.
No, and it comes back to the fact that the government has yet again really put its hopes on the private market to solve the problem of housing rather than what we would suggest might be a better solution.
And it's never going to do that. The private market is in it for a profit. And as soon as prices start coming down in any kind of real way, developers will stop building, as we've seen time and time again over the decades. Developments get staged. The land gets land banked. There is absolutely no incentive for developers to continue to build housing if prices are falling. So it's a fantasy. The only way to provide genuinely affordable housing for people on low incomes is through public housing. Your state has to build it. Everybody goes on about how complicated it is and what a wicked problem it is. It's not a complicated problem at all. It's really, really simple.
In order that
housing is affordable to people on low incomes, only the state can provide it at anything like scale.
And indeed, they're giving it away. I mean, we talk about this often, but we've got the federal government now flogging off defence sites which could be used for housing, which is publicly owned. We've got the state government flogging off five former fire stations in Laverton, Yarraville, Sunshine, West Mount Dunedin, and Moonee Ponds, and then a full page ad in the paper the other week. Part of the Victorian Government property portfolio, a statewide offering comprises 9 properties with development, repositioning and land banking potential, all of which could be public housing.
Yeah. Land banking potential, don't you love that?
Yeah.
The government itself has bought into this complete market paradigm. And, I mean, it is so interesting. I mean, of course, we know that the federal government is building public housing for soldiers in Perth. It used to build public housing for teachers and such. So it is perfectly capable of doing this, and it is still doing it, but it doesn't want to build housing for people on low incomes. It's a completely ideological position. And what you just read out just shows the extent of the embrace of the free market. So the only way that this can be changed is to force the government to change its approach, or change the government, or just create bloody hell and murder. And to that end, I might say, there is a rally coming Saturday.
I was going to raise the same point, so here we go. Okay, Kathy. Okay, yeah.
there's a mass rally for public housing, specifically against the demolitions of the 44 towers in Melbourne, but also for the increase in public housing. It's being organised by RAHU, the Renters and Housing Union, the Safe Public Housing Collective, the Greens, the Victorian Socialists, the Socialist Alliance. There's now more and more the various groups that are working in this space are joining up, which is very, very heartening to me. And there'll be more on this soon, because I think that the only way that change can be forced through is by, you know, solid collective action that does not waver and can't be divided and separated and conquered. So this coming together is really important. I think it's the first sort of real sense of building this mass movement. This coming Saturday, the 30th of May, meeting at 11 a.m. at the State Library, and then we walk around to Atherton Gardens in Fitzroy, the housing estate, and then courtesy of the Greens, there'll be a barbecue there and a gathering. And I think at that gathering, it's a really important and great opportunity for people to really sort of look at the various initiatives that are going on. There's a lot of them. Your listeners might know that, you know, Inner Melbourne Community Legal has been given leave to appeal to the High Court the refusals of previous courts to stop the demolitions. There's a lot of interesting stuff going on, but until now it's all been kind of discreet and you know, there's sort of fires going on here and there. They're starting to join up. So, yeah, I encourage everybody who's listening and their friends and their dogs and everybody else as well to come along to this and really...
11 o'clock Saturday at the State Library, and I assume the keynote speaker is going to be the State Housing Minister. Is it explaining everything to us?
I don't know. They've got a lot of speakers. They're going to have to be quick. who knows? I think the new housing minister is hiding under a rock. We'll see. We'll see.
Yeah, I think at these rallies, I think the most important speakers are the people directly affected, the people being thrown out of their homes, etc. They really bring it home to you, no pun intended, what the problem is.
Yeah, indeed. We also need to bear in mind future residents. So it's, you know, I mean, this is about current, but it's also about future residents. And recalling that and with reference to what we've just been talking about, the role of public housing in housing affordability across the board is crucial. The only way that we are going to take the heat out of the private rental market and the, you know, God forbid, you know, purchase market is to have so much public housing available that people on the lowest incomes can get out of the private rental market and get out of these crap private rentals, and then we can just see a whole lot of churn and mix up in that market when people with better, you know, more means can move into that market as it becomes more affordable because of the lower demand, if you follow me. This is public housing is absolutely the opposition to the demolition of the towers is about the people who are living there now. Nobody wants to see anybody being forcibly, involuntarily evicted from their homes. and there are many, many more aspects to this campaign as well.
And certain local governments wouldn't have to go on punishing the homeless for being homeless, of course. They'd
get a roof over their head. Into it. Yes, absolutely. But yeah, I'm sure you're going to talk about this a lot more. But yes, the actions of Maribyrnong and Port Phillip and the City of Melbourne, I mean, it's really pretty extraordinary, the punitive approach. So, I mean, again...
How do you feel about Port Phillip? Because you cut your planning teeth in that part of the world years ago, Kate.
I did. And I also said in the 1990s, when I left... when I crossed the river, went to the north side, that the place would soon be a Liberal stronghold. And sure enough, not that it makes me happy to see it, but you know, that's the effect of gentrification, right? Yep. You know, there was that kind of early gentrification, and it was all kind of, you know, left and green, and it was really exciting for a while there, but you know, it was new middle class residents wresting control of the council from a deeply right-wing conservative council created the St Kilda Housing Association and all of these wonderful initiatives. But then as time goes on and the area becomes more and more profitable, so the gentrifying, you know, more gentrifying residents come in and prices start to go up again. And it kind of goes back to, not that I'm suggesting there's anything inevitable about it, because, and I've written a lot about this, of course, as you know, but it has now gone back to a right-wing bastion of privilege.
Yeah, that's a great little note to end up. Are you going to get away? Have you got to get away still, or are you still?
Yes, I do have to get away. Oh, that's all right. I'll be late. Oh, don't worry.
Well, Kate, before we do let you get away, there's one of our listeners had a question around what the impact of Airbnbs are on the housing market. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think it's huge. The impact of short stays generally and Airbnbs is taking a whole lot of apartments, mainly, that would be available on the rental market out of that market.
Hmm.
And this is a global problem, right? I mean, in all tourist cities, but I mean in Europe, in Spain in particular,
wow,
it's had a massive impact in places like Malaga and Barcelona. And you might, you know, your listeners might be aware that there have been big campaigns by local residents furious at the lack of available rentals and the occupation of rentals by tourists. And that has resulted, and this is a really nice illustration of what joined up action can do, that has resulted in Sanchez, the Prime Minister, introducing quite stiff controls now. So there are big taxes on Airbnbs, big levies. They have to be registered. There are limits on how many they can be. And if there are any deviations from accepted behaviour and levy payments, they are deregistered. They are made illegal.
That's a note of hope that actually action, public action, can make a difference.
That's right. Mm. It's the only thing that does.
Oh God, we're not going to finish on a positive note, are we?
Hate to do that to the show. Yeah.
Okay, I got to go.
All right, thanks, Kate. Look, thanks for your time, Kate. It's been great.
It's a pleasure.
Okay, right here. Kate Shaw there, who is Melbourne Uni geographer and obviously involved in planning and housing, and we'll take a break, come back, and we're just going to reverse the show and do our normal rave in the second half.
We'll see you then on 3CR with City Limits.
Rally to save public housing. Over 10,000 residents are set to be displaced, with 6,660 homes to be demolished across 44 public housing towers. All this in an ever-worsening housing crisis. Join us at the State Library of Victoria on Saturday the 30th of May at 11 a.m. and then march to the Atherton Gardens public towers in Fitzroy as we fight to save the towers, people's homes and the communities in and around them. After the rally will be a community festival at the towers. The Victorian Labor Government is determined to demolish and privatise public housing and sell off public land to developers. See you on Saturday 30th of May. Together we can stop this madness. Save Public Housing Collective is a 3CR supporter.
Right, yeah, well, that's the rally, of course, next Saturday, and let's hope we get lots of people there. The Herald Sun, in its usual manner, and she talked about the Murdoch, what word she used for it, meritocracy or something.
Murdochracy, however you say it. Yeah.
The front page on Monday, classic, all over the front page, Labor for Terrorist. And the ALP state conference last weekend, which let us know there was a state conference last weekend, that was one thing that we were all quite concerned about, called for the release of Marwan Barghouti, who's the Palestinian, of course, who's been jailed for his activities against Zionists, against the Zionists. And this is regarded as something terrible. And the story inside quoted one Zionist lobby spokesperson after another, attacking Labor for this terrible activity. I keep saying, of course, as I've said on the program before, that as far as Margutti is concerned, it's a case of one person's terrorist being another person's freedom fighter. And he, of course, would regard himself as a freedom fighter for the oppressed Palestinian people. But interesting that one of the key spokespeople said that it was, this does nothing for Palestinians, nothing for peace, and real damage to social cohesion here in Victoria. Now, the nothing for peace bit, they keep talking about the peace bit, but what is the peace process at the moment? I mean, is the peace process that you bomb people into oblivion or what? I can't work that one out.
It's a very Orwellian use of the word peace, isn't it?
It is indeed. And then they didn't quote anyone from the other side putting any point of view that supported Barghouti. And indeed, they really still haven't because, in passing, they interviewed some of the ministers in the government who all sort of said they weren't even there or they denied it or no minister apparently seemed to have voted for it, according to this, or was actually there. But a Manufacturing Workers Union State Secretary, Tony Piccolo, he did say the party moved a series of other motions, including some condemning anti-Semitism. Supporting discussion around Barghouti is not an endorsement of violence, and it's acknowledgement that sustainable peace requires credible political representation, democratic renewal, and engagement with realities on the ground. If we genuinely support a negotiated two-state solution, then we should be willing to contribute ideas that may help break the current impasse rather than deepen division and hostility.
So there is someone looking at the real meaning of peace.
That's good to know. Isn't that good? Isn't that good? Now, speaking of someone who truly believes in peace, of course, is former Minister for Going Overseas, Minister for Foreign Affairs, Julie Bishop. Now, I've mentioned before poor old Julie. We mentioned how in her role as Chancellor at the ANU, she had her office in Perth, so she would be close to the scene, overlooking the Swan River. Which they spent thousands and thousands to renovate for her. She has two staff paid for by the university who, in her role, to help her in a role as Chancellor, who also happen to be staff of her private company that is in that same building. I mentioned this on this show some time ago. Well, there was an interesting article by a woman called Julie Hare who's been following this and... in The Age the other day, "Good riddance, Julie Bishop, your ANU legacy is catastrophic."
Okay.
Now, I'm going to read, because of all that, I'm going to read a fair bit of it, but inter alia.
Okay.
"While it is not uncommon for former politicians to hold these roles, six other universities that goes to the list Gareth Evans and Kim Beazley were also ANU chancellors. First appointed in 2020, her initial three-year term was extended by 4 years in mid-21, but not starting until the end of 22, giving her 7 years in the position. While also running her own consulting firm, Julie Bishop and Partners, the job of Chancellor does not bring financial rewards, a mere $75,000 stipend, but it did come with a big travel budget. In 24, she racked up $150,000 on travel, including trips to New York, London and Japan, all on ANU's purse, while the rest of the university was under strict austerity measures."
Hang on. That's twice your salary spent on
travel.
Right. Okay.
"She was also the only chancellor in the country to have an office away from the main campus. Hers was, as you said, hers was in a glossy glass high-rise with stupendous views over Perth's Swan River, which cost $800,000 a year to run." And that was after the university spent $800,000 renovating it for her in 2021. Not only that, but her two Perth-based part-time ANU staff who were employed to assist her as chancellors were simultaneously employed by Julie Bishop and Partners. and her long-term political staffer and current business partner Murray Hansen was given contracts to write speeches for Bishop as Chancellor, a conflict of interest that was never declared and only revealed during a Senate inquiry.
I think I recall that. Like, one of those speeches cost $30,000.
Yeah, that's right. Well, Bishop's legacy is catastrophic. All that remains to happen now is for the appointed council members to read the room and also hand in their resignations, etc. But I just thought I'd get onto that one because dear old Julie, she's given up. She had to resign.
Yes.
Tragedy, really.
She fell on her feet there in that one.
Did she what? Now, interestingly enough, also we have the governments have now, particularly since Bondi, adopted Gillian Siegel's recommendation for a definition of anti-Semitism, which many people believe does limit your right to criticise Israel as such.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, what is the definition? I mean, we all oppose anti-Semitism totally, but we certainly reserve that right. But interesting enough, the ABC and SBS have both declined to adopt the definition and say they will simply do what they do now, and they, you know, they certainly oppose anti-Semitism, etc. But there's quite a thing going on there. But they've been trying to, she's trying to force them into it. And in fact, in her report, she said institutions such as the ABC and SBS should be withheld if the funding for them should be withheld if they are found to have promoted division or spread false or distorted narratives. And of course, she also called for university funding to be slashed if they continued their alleged anti-Semitism.
If the legacy media did adopt that definition, that would have quite an impact on how they can report.
It certainly would, yeah. That's right. So that's an ongoing one. And the other one with the ABC that's ongoing is that One Nation keeps locking them out of meetings and things. The night of the election, the Farrah by-election, the ABC got to the door and were thrown out. They're not allowed into press conferences and things, so there's a bit going on there. It's all lovely, isn't it? Now, also this week, there's been a thing called the Enhanced Games, which is pretty dreadful. I think it might be over by now, but it was big money involved, but it was athletes who were allowed to be drugged up, so they're enhanced. And they mentioned about various peptides that are being sold that are without any real care as to what's in them and what might be in them and how dangerous they are. But interestingly enough, on the same day that they that the Enhanced Games were being praised and how wonderful, not necessarily praised, but it were talked about in that term, head front page headline, Victorians are landing in emergency departments after suffering severe side effects linked to illegal peptides, including, and it goes on and on, but how dangerous they are. But you know, the idea of having games where people can take those things and enhance, I mean, it just defeats the whole purpose. I mean, the fact is that in the other games anyway, you suspect half them are dosed up in the first place, I mean, particularly American sprinters. I mean, they keep getting sprung all the time. But,
sprinters getting sprung. Yeah, well, it has a big influence, the sports, and how the sports people behave and, you know, then what people think is reasonable behaviour to do themselves. So I can understand why those peptide problems are increasing.
Yeah, well, remember Flo Jo, who was sort of a great hero of years ago, the 90s, wasn't she? I think Flo Jo, the great American sprinter, but then she died because of all the drugs she was taking. I mean,
she
died at a very young age, so they certainly get sprung. In fact, one of them who got sprung twice recently gave advice to someone about drugs or something, and he was critical of someone even though he himself had been sprung twice, which I found quite fascinating. Speaking of SBS, the Indigenous Channel, that people might have seen it, but it's 10 o'clock today as we go off air, a repeat of The Point. The Point last night was set in Melbourne, and there's a long interview with our Robbie Thorpe, who'll be on here at 11 o'clock, and about the history and what's happening at Camp Sovereignty, and there's other stories around Melbourne and young people involved in Indigenous issues around Melbourne, but there's a really good interview when 3CR gets acknowledged as helping out, in fact, at the in the final credits. But so if anyone wants to watch, didn't see it and wants to watch it, it's on at 10 o'clock as we go off air, actually.
Coming up.
A repeat of this morning on on NITV, yeah. Robbie was in full flight.
He does know how to educate us.
Which is good to see. Let's take a break. We'll take a, we'll have a song or something and I'll come back and have more of this crap.
Okay, we'll be back. 3CR City Limits.
I was raised out of steel-haired swamps in Jersey some misty years ago. Through the mud and the beer, the blood and the cheers, I seen champions come and go. So if you got the guts, mister, if you got the balls, you think it's your time, then step to the line and bring on your wrecking ball. Bring on your wrecking ball. Bring on your wrecking ball. Come on and take your best shot. Let me see what you got. Come on, your wrecking ball. Now my home's here in these meadowlands, where mosquitoes grow big as airplanes. Here where the blood is spilled, the arena's filled, and giants play games. So raise up your glass. Let me hear your voices call. It's tonight all the dead are here. So bring on your wrecking ball. Bring on your wrecking ball. Bring on your wrecking ball. Come on and take your best shot. Let me see what you've got. Bring on your
That was Wrecking Ball with Bruce Springsteen, and you are with Anne and Kevin Healy for City Limits this morning with Kevin's got the news of the day.
Well, yes, we're going. Well, it's interesting given that we've been talking about the poor capitalist suffering under the federal budget and the world's
it's been a rough time
the world's them. Crashing to an end. Well, the other side of the point is that apparently the food bank says that parents are going without food to feed their children, and that even people with jobs are having real trouble at the moment. We've moved from providing 69,000 meals a day to 76,000, and obviously those meals are people, so that's quite an increase across the community. And we've heard harrowing stories from families pushed to the edge, including parents choosing to forego food so their kids can eat, which is a trend on the rise, which is pretty awful. And I think that's reflected in the fact that also there was a story in the last week or so that disadvantaged students are worse off today than when NAPLAN was introduced, as the chasm between rich and poor students in Australia grows. Mm. And, of course, it's the old story of the private schools, public schools, and where you live and all that. So it's all reflected that, unfortunately,
Yeah.
It's having a dreadful impact.
Yeah, well, inequality is correlated with all sorts of social ills, including levels of achievements in school. So all you have to do, Kevin, it's a one fixed solution. You just have to fix inequality and a whole lot of other things will fall into place.
Oh, well, that's a simple solution then.
Mm. And that would help if we didn't have a budget recently that's actually an austerity budget where they're going to be pulling more money out of people's pockets.
Yeah, there would be a simple solution if it wasn't for governments and capitalists.
So true. If we didn't have those.
If we get rid of those, we're in business.
That's right.
Now, interestingly enough, I think we're all aware of the Griffith Society, the Samuel Griffith Society, which was formed, by the way, by right-wing lawyers in 1992 because they were so upset about the Mabo judgment.
That's where it came about. Okay.
And in fact, one of the papers at the time by a lawyer compared Mabo to a disease, one Griffith Society speaker, a bloke called Kenneth Minogue, described Indigenous people as a pretty incompetent lot who are difficult to help. Mm. and anyway, a High Court Judge, Robert Beach Jones, has come out attacking them. He, in fact, says they're trying to stack the benches of the court benches with their own types.
Wow.
Including Simon Stewart, who's the most conservative of the current High Court bunch. And he was praised at Griffith Society conference as a conservative in the proudest tradition, which is the conservation of precedent, by another High Court judge, James Edelman. According to Beach Jones, they're really moving to what he calls what's happening in America, where Trump is putting all his own people on the benches. And
yes.
They're trying to do the same thing here.
Yes, they're copying that American playbook.
Yep.
Which is not good.
And he's quite critical of it. Mm. But then Mia Schlitt, who's the Griffith Society Executive Director, said it was inappropriate for a serving judge to attempt to shut down criticism of how the High Court was interpreting the Constitution. The Samuel Griffith Society is a debating society, not a political organisation, she said. We hold a simple view that judges should apply the Constitution as written, not as they think it ought to be written. We invite contributions from across the board, etc. She also defended their student chapter program, which she said existed because university law schools have become ideological monocultures. We want students to encounter arguments that will not hear in the lecture theatre. Now, I think that means you'll hear the views of the most conservative.
Most extreme. You won't hear them.
But her background, and Mia Schlitt obviously is a person who thinks on all sides of arguments, because she's not only now running the Samuel Griffith Society, but she's also was a fellow at the Institute of Public Affairs before she went there. Yes,
surely there's no connection.
Yes, apparently there is. So
I'm surprised.
Yeah. Now, this is one that will surprise you.
Okay.
I think we only need to read the headline to know what it means terms of what's happened since the budget. You can read it, actually. I'll hold it up for you.
There you are. I'll have a read of it for you. The real winners out of Labor's budget shake-up. Tax lawyers.
Yes. What a surprise.
They get it coming and going, don't they? Change the tax this way, change the tax law that way.
What a surprise. See, they've got to continue to pay their legal tax obligations, which you achieve by paying none. And now they look like they might have to pay some. They've got to get their tax lawyers to make sure they still pay their legal tax obligations by paying none.
Oh, fantastic.
So, yes, it's all go. Now, also, Ryan Stokes, who's the scion of Kerry Stokes, who's the big West Australian capitalist who runs the Channel 7 and other things. And, in fact, their empire covers a lot of things these days. They've got investments in a heap of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he's pretty upset about the budget, I must admit. He says the tax reform unveiled in the budget punished aspiration, failed to boost the economy, and could force businesses to invest overseas. Now, this, you know,
You're crying.
I'm taking this criticism to heart, Kevin,
You're in distress,
I am.
Look, I'm sorry. I'll have to go on, but I don't want you to feel too bad about this. But it does punish aspiration, and it generally ignores productivity. He's joined a backlash by business leaders and investors. It ultimately grows debt, and I don't think it serves the country, he said.
You see, you know what? If they all run off and invest overseas, that might give the federal government some room to invest for some public goods. That'd be terrible, wouldn't it?
It would, wouldn't it? And particularly, I noticed that Gina's also threatened that the resource people could head off overseas now. But the stuff's in the ground here. I mean, the fact is,
I don't know which is better, sending them overseas or off to Mars. I'm not sure.
If they leave it in the ground here, we wouldn't mind too much,
no,
I suppose.
I don't think we would.
That's okay, because it cuts a bit of pollution. Anyway, he says this is not tax reform. It's a higher cost of deploying capital in Australia at a moment when the global capital pool is more mobile than ever. You'll be pleased to know that despite the fact that he's crying poor, the Stokes family, the company they run, has a $17 billion industrial investment, including, of course, we know Channel 7, etc., but also Boral, Coates, Westrack, and they also have a stake in Beach Energy. So they're doing their bit for society. And, so you've got a feel for them, haven't you?
I do. And it was hardly a big move in the budget anyway, so I don't know.
Oh,
they're very sensitive. They're like
hardly. They're going to pay. They might have to pay some tax. Investors face 50% more tax. The front page. The Fin Review's been at it day after day.
Yes.
They're really into it. They're taking it big time. Investors face. But that's sort of a typical daily headline in that paper. After a long, long time, Donald Trump has finally appointed a new ambassador to Australia.
Mm.
Bloke called David Bratt, which is an interesting name,
mm-hmm.
And he's a former member. He was a member of that Tea Party, that really right-wing group, back, and now he's a great supporter of Donald.
Grassroots activism.
Yeah, and he's part of a mob called the Freedom Caucus. Well, once they put freedom in their name, you know,
you know where they're coming from.
It's going well. And Donald says that if he's confirmed in the role, his three priorities, and he's going to be, I think he has been by now, actually, anyway, his three priorities will be critical minerals, defence cooperation and partnership in the Indo-Pacific, quote, amidst China's unprecedented military build-up. That's why America has to build up and send all those ships around China's seas, etc., to help out, obviously.
Do you ever feel like you're a pawn in the game?
No, well, I've just seen something flying to the floor. I'll just get it.
Kevin's actually literally disappearing from my line of vision here.
All's well. I just have to get my foot on that. We've got it. It was probably, I just thought it might be the next thing I wanted to talk about. Oh, no, it's just Gina. Oh, it's Gina, actually. Yeah, well,
Gina went flying, did she?
Oh, dear. Gina hit the ground.
Yeah.
He says that we can bolster our alliance of our regional partners to help to fight against the malign influence of our adversities. The United States is a Pacific nation, and our partnership with Australia maintains our edge in this vast strategic. They keep talking up war all the time. I mean, it's just extraordinary. So he's going to be a real benefit to us when he lobs.
A real hawk. Is he going to bring some submarines with him? is that the idea?
Well, he supports us giving all the money for submarines, so that's good. And the Gina one is not unrelated to that, because she's, apart from all her other investments,
mm-hmm.
Gina has just spent $139 million on Merchants of Death companies in America, Hancock Prox. They bought up RTX, Northrop Grumman, L3 Harris Technologies and Lockheed Martin. And so she's endearing herself to Donald by buying up... she has bought a little property at Mar-a-Lago, of course. So, yeah. But interesting on that, I haven't got it in front of me, but the notice the government says that... there's going to be exceptions in terms of some of the tax concessions, etc., to farmers, to the mm-hmm. primary industry.
Oh, yeah, like with the family trusts and
That's
so
right,
on.
And family trusts will not be hit by if they're...
Yeah, farmers are asset-rich and income-poor,
yeah,
usually.
That's right, yes. Mm. Well, a good example of asset-rich and poor, of course, is Gina herself.
Oh, Gina, of course.
And Gina... apart from, of course, her mining interests and now her defence interests and her defence and everything else, also is a huge pastoralist. So yeah. I think she'll suddenly declare herself primarily to be a primary industry person and I assume, therefore, make sure that she can benefit from
there's
the government's concessions.
There's farmers and then there's
farmers,
isn't
although, there? In Gina's case, a family trust would be a bit difficult because... No one in the family trusts anyone. No one trusts anyone in that family. So anyway, but she's. I'm sure she'll sort it out.
The family. Yes, bun fight.
Yeah, that's right. Now there's another interesting story floating around. That
literally floating in the studio
well,
around here.
Yeah. No, I'll put that one aside. It's about the fact that. Collection of batteries, they're not being disposed... Well, there's an argument that they're not being disposed of properly by the company that's getting paid to dispose of them properly.
Right,
but that might be
save
a future,
that for a
waste, future story,
I'm kind of curious because I'm seeing my local supermarkets now taking soft plastic again. And I'm kind of curious as to where that's going.
Yeah, well, that's, well, you've got to know where it goes once you put it in. But anyway. Now, I think one of the good stories this week... I hate to do this on City Limits, but the International Court of Justice, which has been hearing a case for ages, finally brought down its decision that the right to strike is, in fact, a right workers have.
Wow.
And, yes. So
we have international law saying this now.
Yeah, late last week, it said the right to strike is protected by an International Labour Organization Convention on Freedom of Association. And it opens the path for, for the strikes that are currently banned in Australia, unprotected action, but also supporting other people in strike action, which has been banned for a long time since Howard and Co. And so the suggestion now is that this, and in fact, a lawyer who's involved with the employer side said this was pretty dangerous. It could open up the world for Australia to have even, more dangerous industrial laws, which is a real problem.
Maybe the industrial lawyers will make the headlines.
Yes. So, just in case we get a bit too excited about it.
Okay.
Yeah, a government made a submission to the court case that just finished.
Mm-hmm.
And argued that the right to strike was, quote, not unlimited, and a wider range of appreciation was warranted for strike restrictions than for other aspects of freedom of association, given the economic impact. So that's not a good starting point.
No, it is not.
Not a good starting point, but at least they've ruled that you have a right to strike, and this might broaden out at least, the workers' rights.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That is... moderately good news, Kevin.
It is moderately good news, and let's hope the government doesn't proceed with that particular argument, though.
Yeah.
I'm losing my voice. That's good timing, so we're just about finished.
All righty. Well, you are on 3CR with City Limits.
That proves I've lost my voice.
Kevin is
we better mention, though, that in 2 weeks' time, of course, we've got our Radiothon program.
And
So as I said last week, if anyone's got can write out a cheque for... I think it's $2,000-something for City Limits. We'll accept it gladly.
Pop an extra zero on there.
That's right. Just whack it in the mail. Yeah.
We do need the money. It doesn't go to waste. We're not saying this frivolously. We actually do seriously need whatever you can offer. And people often think, if I just give $5 or $10, that doesn't count. It helps. If everybody who listened gave $10,
and
it would
be huge. Festival every year of 3CR and its listeners, because we are a community station, and so the community we're all part of that community.
It boosts us too to hear from you that way.
Yeah.
Well,
okay. And next week's transport.
Transport next week.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.